Chapter 6. A Science of Good and Evil. Is the difference between good and evil just a matter of what any particular group of human beings says it is? Consider that one of the greatest sources of amusement in 16th century Paris was cat burning. At the Midsummer's Fair, an impresario would gather dozens of cats in a net, hoist them high into the air from a special stage, and then, to everyone's delight, lower the whole writhing bundle onto a bonfire. The assembled spectators shrieked with laughter as the animals, howling with pain, were singed, roasted, and finally carbonized. Most of us would recoil from such a spectacle today. But would we be right to do so? Can we say that there are ethical truths of which all avid torturers of cats are ignorant? Many people appear to believe that ethical truths are culturally contingent, in a way that scientific truths are not. Indeed, this loss of purchase upon ethical truth seems to be one of the principal shortcomings of secularism. The problem is that once we abandon our belief in a rule-making God, the question of why a given action is good or bad becomes a matter of debate. And a statement like, "murder is wrong," while being uncontroversial in most circles, has never seemed anchored to the facts of this world in the way that statements about planets or molecules appear to be. The problem, in philosophical terms, has been one of characterizing just what sort of facts our moral intuitions can be said to track, if indeed they track anything of the kind. A rational approach to ethics becomes possible once we realize that questions of right and wrong are really questions about the happiness and suffering of sentient creatures. If we are in a position to affect the happiness or suffering of others, we have ethical responsibilities toward them, and many of these responsibilities are so grave as to become matters of civil and criminal law. Taking happiness and suffering as our starting point, we can see that much of what people worry about under the guise of morality has nothing to do with the subject. It is time we realize that crimes without victims are like debts without creditors. They do not even exist. Any person who lies awake at night worrying about the private pleasures of other consenting adults has more than just too much time on his hands. He has some unjustifiable beliefs about the nature of right and wrong. The fact that people of different times and cultures disagree about ethical questions should not trouble us. It suggests nothing at all about the status of moral truth. Imagine what it would be like to consult the finest thinkers of antiquity on questions of basic science. What, we might ask, is fire? And how do living systems reproduce themselves? And what are the various lights we see in the night sky? We would surely encounter a bewildering lack of consensus on these matters. Even though there was no shortage of brilliant minds in the ancient world, they simply lacked the physical and conceptual tools to answer questions of this sort. Their lack of consensus signified their ignorance of certain physical truths. Not that no such truths exist. If there are right and wrong answers to ethical questions, these answers will best be sought in the living present. Whether our search takes us to a secluded cave or to a modern laboratory makes no difference to the existence of the facts in question. If ethics represents a genuine sphere of knowledge, it represents a sphere of potential progress and regress. The relevance of tradition to this area of discourse, as to all others, will be as a support for present inquiry. Where our traditions are not supportive, they become mere vehicles of ignorance. The pervasive idea that religion is somehow the source of our deepest ethical intuitions is absurd. We no more get our sense that cruelty is wrong from the pages of the Bible than we get our sense that 2 + 2 = 4 from the pages of a textbook on mathematics. Anyone who does not harbor some rudimentary sense that cruelty is wrong is unlikely to learn that it is by reading. And indeed, most scripture offers rather equivocal testimony to this fact in any case. Our ethical intuitions must have their precursors in the natural world. For while nature is indeed red in tooth and claw, it is not merely so. Even monkeys will undergo extraordinary privations to avoid causing harm to another member of their species. Concern for others was not the invention of any prophet. The fact that our ethical intuitions have their roots in biology reveals that our efforts to ground ethics in religious conceptions of moral duty are misguided. Saving a drowning child is no more a moral duty than understanding a syllogism is a logical one. We simply do not need religious ideas to motivate us to live ethical lives. Once we begin thinking seriously about happiness and suffering, we find that our religious traditions are no more reliable on questions of ethics than they have been on scientific questions generally. The anthropocentrism that is intrinsic to every faith cannot help appearing impossibly quaint, and therefore impossible, given what we now know about the natural world. Biological truths are simply not commensurate with a designer God, or even a good one. The perverse wonder of evolution is this: the very mechanisms that create the incredible beauty and diversity of the living world guarantee monstrosity and death. The child born without limbs, the sightless fly, the vanished species, these are nothing less than Mother Nature caught in the act of throwing her clay. No perfect God could maintain such incongruities. It is worth remembering that if God created the world and all things in it, He created smallpox, plague, and filariasis. Any person who intentionally loosed such horrors upon the earth would be ground to dust for his crimes. The deity who stalked the deserts of the Middle East millennia ago, and who seems to have abandoned them to bloodshed in his name ever since, is no one to consult on questions of ethics. Indeed, to judge him on the basis of his works is a highly invidious undertaking. Bertrand Russell got here first. Apart from logical cogency, there is to me something a little odd about the ethical valuations of those who think that an omnipotent, omniscient, and benevolent deity, after preparing the ground by many millions of years of lifeless nebulae, would consider himself adequately rewarded by the final emergence of Hitler and Stalin and the H-bomb. This is a devastating observation, and there is no retort to it. In the face of God's obvious inadequacies, the pious have generally held that one cannot apply earthly norms to the creator of the universe. This argument loses its force the moment we notice that the creator, who purports to be beyond human judgment, is consistently ruled by human passions, jealousy, wrath, suspicion, and the lust to dominate. A close study of our holy books reveals that the God of Abraham is a ridiculous fellow, capricious, petulant, and cruel, and one with whom a covenant is little guarantee of health or happiness. If these are the characteristics of God, then the worst among us have been created far more in His image than we ever could have hoped. The problem of vindicating an omnipotent and omniscient God in the face of evil, this is traditionally called the problem of theodicy, is insurmountable. Those who claim to have surmounted it by recourse to notions of free will and other incoherencies, have merely heaped bad philosophy onto bad ethics. Surely there must come a time when we will acknowledge the obvious. Theology is now little more than a branch of human ignorance. Indeed, it is ignorance with wings. Ethics and the Sciences of Mind. The connection between ethics and the scientific understanding of consciousness, while rarely made, is ineluctable, for other creatures become the objects of our ethical concern only insofar as we attribute consciousness, or perhaps potential consciousness, to them. That most of us feel no ethical obligations toward rocks, to treat them with kindness, to make sure they do not suffer unduly, can be derived from the fact that most of us do not believe that there is anything that it is like to be a rock. While a science of consciousness is still struggling to be born, it is sufficient for our purposes to note that the problem of ascertaining our ethical obligations to non-human animals, as well as to humans who have suffered neurological injury, to human fetuses, to blastocysts, etc., requires that we better understand the relationship between mind and matter. Do crickets suffer? I take it as a given that this question is both coherently posed and has an answer, whether or not we will ever be in a position to answer it ourselves. This is the point at which our notions about mind and matter directly influence our notions of right and wrong. We should recall that the practice of vivisection was given new life by certain missteps in the philosophy of mind, when Descartes, in thrall to both Christian dogma and mechanistic physics, declared that all non-human animals were mere automata, devoid of souls, and therefore insensible to pain. One of his contemporaries observed the immediate consequences of this view. The scientists administered beatings to dogs with perfect indifference and made fun of those who pitied the creatures as if they felt pain. They said the animals were clocks, that the cries they emitted when struck were only the noise of a little spring that had been touched, but that the whole body was without feeling. They nailed the poor animals up on boards by their four paws to vivisect them to see the circulation of blood, which was a great subject of controversy. Cognitive chauvinism of this sort has not merely been a problem for animals. The doubt on the part of Spanish explorers about whether or not South American Indians had souls surely contributed to the callousness with which they treated them during their conquest of the New World. Admittedly, it is difficult to say just how far down the phylogenic tree our ethical responsibilities run. Our intuitions about the consciousness of other animals are driven by a variety of factors, many of which probably have no bearing upon whether or not they are conscious. For instance, creatures that lack facial expressiveness, or faces at all, are more difficult to include within the circle of our moral concern. It seems that until we more fully understand the relationship between brains and minds, our judgments about the possible scope of animal suffering will remain relatively blind and relatively dogmatic. There will probably come a time when we achieve a detailed understanding of human happiness and of ethical judgments themselves at the level of the brain. Just as defects in color vision can result from genetic and developmental disorders, problems can undoubtedly arise in our ethical and emotional circuitry as well. To say that a person is colorblind or achromatopsic is now a straightforward statement about the state of the visual pathways in his brain, while to say that he is an evil sociopath or lacking in moral fiber seems hopelessly unscientific. This will almost certainly change. If there are truths to be known about how human beings conspire to make one another happy or miserable, there are truths to be known about ethics. A scientific understanding of the link between intentions, human relationships, and states of happiness would have much to say about the nature of good and evil, and about the proper response to the moral transgressions of others. There is every reason to believe that sustained inquiry in the moral sphere will force convergence of our various belief systems in the way that it has in every other science, that is, among those who are adequate to the task. That so little convergence has been achieved in ethics can be ascribed to the fact that so few of the facts are in. Indeed, we have yet to agree about the most basic criteria for deeming an ethical fact a fact. So many conversations have not yet been had. So many intuitions have not yet been exercised. So many arguments have not yet been won. Our reliance upon religious dogma explains this. Most of our religions have been no more supportive of genuine moral inquiry than of scientific inquiry generally. This is a problem that only new rules of discourse can overcome. When was the last time that someone was criticized for not respecting another person's unfounded beliefs about physics or history? The same rule should apply to ethical, spiritual, and religious beliefs as well. Credit goes to Christopher Hitchens for distilling, in a single phrase, a principle of discourse that could well arrest our slide toward the abyss. What can be asserted without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence. Let us pray that billions of us soon agree with him. Moral communities. The notion of a moral community resolves many paradoxes of human behavior. How is it, after all, that a Nazi guard could return each day from his labors at the crematoria and be a loving father to his children? The answer is surprisingly straightforward. The Jews he spent the day torturing and killing were not objects of his moral concern. Not only were they outside his moral community, they were antithetical to it. His beliefs about Jews inured him to the natural human sympathies that might have otherwise prevented such behavior. Unfortunately, religion casts more shadows than light on this terrain. Rather than find real reasons for human solidarity, faith offers us a solidarity born of tribal and tribalizing fictions. As we have seen, religion is one of the great limiters of moral identity, since most believers differentiate themselves, in moral terms, from those who do not share their faith. No other ideology is so eloquent on the subject of what divides one moral community from another. Once a person accepts the premises upon which most religious identities are built, the withdrawal of his moral concern from those who do not share these premises follows quite naturally. Needless to say, the suffering of those who are destined for hell can never be as problematic as the suffering of the righteous. If certain people can't see the unique wisdom and sanctity of my religion, if their hearts are so beclouded by sin, what concern is it of mine if others mistreat them? They have been cursed by the very God who made the world and all things in it. Their search for happiness was simply doomed from the start. New problems arise once we commit ourselves to finding a rational foundation for our ethics. Indeed, we find that it is difficult to draw the boundaries of our moral concern in a principled way. It is clear, for instance, that susceptibility to pain cannot be our only criteria. As Richard Rorty observes, if pain were all that mattered, it would be as important to protect the rabbits from the foxes as to protect the Jews from the Nazis. In virtue of what have we convinced ourselves that we need not intercede on behalf of all rabbits? Most of us suspect rabbits are not capable of experiencing happiness or suffering on a human scale. Admittedly, we could be wrong about this. And if it ever seems that we have underestimated the subjectivity of rabbits, our ethical stance toward them would no doubt change. Incidentally, here is where a rational answer to the abortion debate is lurking. Many of us consider human fetuses in the first trimester to be more or less like rabbits, having imputed to them a range of happiness and suffering that does not grant them full status in our moral community. At present, this seems rather reasonable. Only future scientific insights could refute this intuition. The problem of specifying the criteria for inclusion in our moral community is one for which I do not have a detailed answer, other than to say that whatever answer we give should reflect our sense of the possible subjectivity of the creatures in question. Some answers are clearly wrong. We cannot merely say, for instance, that all human beings are in and all animals are out. What will be our criterion for humanness? DNA? Shall a single human cell take precedence over a herd of elephants? The problem is that whatever attribute we use to differentiate between humans and animals, intelligence, language use, moral sentiments, and so on, will equally differentiate between human beings themselves. If people are more important to us than orangutans because they can articulate their interests, Why aren't more articulate people more important still? And what about those poor men and women with aphasia? It would seem that we have just excluded them from our moral community. Find an orangutan that can complain about his family in Borneo, and he may well displace a person or two from our lifeboat. The Demon of Relativism. We saw in Chapter 2 that for our beliefs to function logically, indeed, for them to be beliefs at all, we must also believe that they faithfully represent states of the world. This suggests that some systems of belief will appear more faithful than others, in that they will account for more of the data of experience and make better predictions about future events. And yet, many intellectuals tend to speak as though something in the last century of ratiocination in the West has placed all worldviews more or less on an equal footing. No one is ever really right about what he believes. He can only point to a community of peers who believe likewise. Suicide bombing isn't really wrong in any absolute sense. It just seems so from the parochial perspective of Western culture. Throw a dash of Thomas Kuhn into this pot, and everyone can agree that we never really know how the world is, because each new generation of scientists reinvents the laws of nature to suit its taste. Convictions of this sort generally go by the name of relativism, and they seem to offer a rationale for not saying anything too critical about the beliefs of others. But most forms of relativism, including moral relativism, which seems especially well subscribed, are nonsensical and dangerously so. Some may think that it is immaterial whether we think the Nazis were really wrong in ethical terms, or whether we just don't like their style of life. It seems to me, however, that the belief that some worldviews really are better than others taps a different set of intellectual and moral resources. These are resources we will desperately need if we are to oppose and ultimately unseat the regnant ignorance and tribalism of our world. The general retort to relativism is simple, because most relativists contradict their thesis in the very act of stating it. Take the case of relativism with respect to morality. Moral relativists generally believe that all cultural practices should be respected on their own terms, that the practitioners of the various barbarisms that persist around the globe cannot be judged by the standards of the West, nor can the people of the past be judged by the standards of the present. And yet, implicit in this approach to morality lurks a claim that is not relative, but absolute. Most moral relativists believe that tolerance of cultural diversity is better, in some important sense, than outright bigotry. This may be perfectly reasonable, of course, but it amounts to an overarching claim about how all human beings should live. Moral relativism, when used as a rationale for tolerance of diversity, is self-contradictory. There is, however, a more sophisticated version of this line of thinking that is not so easily dispatched. It generally goes by the name of pragmatism, and its most articulate spokesman is undoubtedly Richard Rorty. While Rorty is not a household name, his work has had a great influence on our discourse, and it offers considerable shelter to the shades of relativism. If we ever hope to reach a global consensus on matters of ethics, if we would say, for instance, that stoning women for adultery is really wrong in some absolute sense, we must find deep reasons to reject pragmatism. Doing so, we will discover that we are in a position to make strong cross-cultural claims about the reasonableness of various systems of belief and about good and evil. The pragmatist's basic premise is that, try as we might, the currency of our ideas cannot be placed on the gold standard of correspondence with reality as it is. To call a statement true is merely to praise it for how it functions in some area of discourse. It is not to say anything about how it relates to the universe at large. From the point of view of pragmatism, the notion that our beliefs might correspond with reality is absurd. Beliefs are simply tools for making one's way in the world. Does a hammer correspond with reality? No. It has merely proven its usefulness for certain tasks. So it is, we are told, with the truths of biology, history, or any other field. For the pragmatist, the utility of a belief trumps all other concerns, even the concern for coherence. If a literalist reading of the Bible works for you on Sundays, while agnosticism about God is better suited to Mondays at the office, there is no reason to worry about the resulting contradictions in your worldview. These are not so much incompatible claims about the way the world is, as different styles of talking, each suited to a particular occasion. If all of this seems rather academic, it might be interesting to note that Sayyid Qutb, Osama bin Laden's favorite philosopher, felt that pragmatism would spell the death of American civilization. He thought that it would, in Berman's phrase, undermine America's ability to fend off its enemies. There may be some truth to this assertion. Pragmatism, when civilizations come clashing, does not appear likely to be very pragmatic. To lose the conviction that you can actually be right about anything seems a recipe for the end-of-days chaos envisioned by Yeats when the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I believe that relativism and pragmatism have already done much to muddle our thinking on a variety of subjects, many of which have more than a passing relevance to the survival of civilization. In philosophical terms, pragmatism can be directly opposed to realism. For the realist, our statements about the world will be true or false, not merely in virtue of how they function amid the welter of our other beliefs, or with reference to any culture-bound criteria, but because reality simply is a certain way, independent of our thoughts. Realists believe that there are truths about the world that may exceed our capacity to know them. There are facts of the matter, whether or not we can bring such facts into view. To be an ethical realist is to believe that in ethics, as in physics, there are truths waiting to be discovered, and thus we can be right or wrong in our beliefs about them. According to pragmatists like Rorty, realism is doomed because there is no way to compare our description of reality with a piece of undescribed reality. As Jürgen Habermas says, since the truth of beliefs or sentences can in turn be justified only with the help of other beliefs and sentences, we cannot break free from the magic circle of our language. This is a clever thesis, but is it true? The fact that language is the medium in which our knowledge is represented and communicated says nothing at all about the possibilities of unmediated knowledge, per se. The fact that no experience, when talked about, escapes being mediated by language, this is a tautology, does not mean that all cognition, and hence all knowing, is interpretive. If it were possible for any facet of reality to be known perfectly, if certain mystics, for instance, were right to think that they had enjoyed unmediated knowledge of transcendental truths, then pragmatism would be just plain wrong, realistically. The problem for the pragmatist is not that such a mystic stands a good chance of being right. The problem is that, whether the mystic is right or wrong, he must be right or wrong realistically. In opposing the idea that we can know reality directly, the pragmatist has made a covert, realistic claim about the limits of human knowledge. Pragmatism amounts to a realistic denial of the possibility of realism. And so, like the relativist, the pragmatist appears to reach a contradiction before he has even laced his shoes. Relativists and pragmatists believe that truth is just a matter of consensus. I think it is clear, however, that while consensus among like minds may be the final arbiter of truth, it cannot constitute it. It is quite conceivable that everyone might agree and yet be wrong about the way the world is. It is also conceivable that a single person might be right in the face of unanimous opposition. From a realist point of view, it is possible though unlikely, for a single person or culture to have a monopoly on the truth. It would seem, therefore, that nothing stands in the way of our presuming that our beliefs about the world can correspond, to a greater or lesser degree, to the way the world is. Whether or not we will ever be in a position to finally authenticate such correspondence, given that there are likely to be truths to be known about how members of our species can be made as happy as possible, there are almost certainly truths to be known about ethics. To say that we will never agree on every question of ethics is the same as saying that we will never agree on every question of physics. In neither case does the open-endedness of our inquiry suggest that there are no real facts to be known, or that some of the answers we have in hand are not really better than some others. Respect for diversity in our ethical views is, at best, an intellectual holding pattern until more of the facts are in. Intuition. One cannot walk far in the company of moral theorists without hearing our faculty of moral intuition either exalted or scorned. The reason for the latter attitude is that the term intuition has always carried the scent of impropriety in philosophical and scientific discourse, having been regularly disgraced by its appearance in colloquialisms like woman's intuition, meaning psychic, or otherwise directly contrasted with reason. The word now seems to conjure up all that is cloying and irrational outside the university gates. The only striking exception to this rule is to be found among mathematicians, who apparently speak of their intuitions without the least embarrassment, rather like travelers to exotic places in the developing world, who can often be heard discussing the misadventures of their colon over breakfast. But, as we know, mathematicians travel to very exotic places indeed. We might also note that many of them admit to being philosophical Platonists, without feeling any apparent need to consult a trained philosopher for an exorcism. Whatever its stigma, intuition is a term that we simply cannot do without, because it denotes the most basic constituent of our faculty of understanding. While this is true in matters of ethics, it is no less true in science. When we can break our knowledge of a thing down no further, the irreducible leap that remains is intuitively taken. Thus, the traditional opposition between reason and intuition is a false one. Reason is itself intuitive to the core, as any judgment that a proposition is reasonable or logical relies on intuition to find its feet. One often hears scientists and philosophers concede that something or other is a brute fact, that is, one that admits of no reduction. The question of why physical events have causes, say, is not one that scientists feel the slightest temptation to ponder. It is just so. To demand an accounting of so basic a fact is like asking how we know that 2 + 2 = 4. Scientists presuppose the validity of such brutishness, as indeed they must. The point, I trust, is obvious. We cannot step out of the darkness without taking a first step. And reason, without knowing how, understands this axiom, if it would understand anything at all. The reliance on intuition, therefore, should be no more discomforting for the ethicist than it has been for the physicist. We are all tugging at the same bootstraps. It is also true that our intuitions have been known to fail. Indeed, many of the deliverances of reason do not seem reasonable at first glance. When asked how thick a piece of newspaper would be if one could fold it upon itself 100 times in succession, most of us imagine something about the size of a brick. A little arithmetic reveals, however, that such an object would be as thick as the known universe. If we've learned anything in the last 2,000 years, it is that a person's sense of what is reasonable sometimes needs a little help finding its feet. Or consider the unreliable species of intuition that might be summed up in the statement, "Like breeds like." Yielding, sympathetic magic, and other obvious affronts to reason. Is it reasonable to believe, as many Chinese apparently do, that tiger bone wine leads to virility? No, it is not. Could it become reasonable? Indeed, it could. We need only be confronted with a well-run, controlled study yielding a significant correlation between tiger bones and human prowess. Would a reasonable person expect to find such a correlation? It does not seem very likely. But if it came, reason would be forced to yield its present position, which is that the Chinese are destroying a wondrous species of animal for no reason at all. But notice that the only manner in which we can criticize the intuitive content of magical thinking is by resort to the intuitive content of rational thinking. Controlled study? Correlation? Why do these criteria persuade us at all? Isn't it just obvious that if one doesn't exclude other possible causes of increased potency, the placebo effect, delusion, environmental factors, differences in health among the subjects, etc., one will have failed to isolate the variable of tiger bones effects on the human body? Yes, it's just as obvious as a poke in the eye. Why is it obvious? Once again, we hit bedrock. As Wittgenstein said, our spade is turned. The fact that we must rely on certain intuitions to answer ethical questions does not in the least suggest that there is anything insubstantial, ambiguous, or culturally contingent about ethical truth. As in any other field, there will be room for intelligent dissent on questions of right and wrong. But intelligent dissent has its limits. People who believe the earth is flat are not dissenting geographers. People who deny the Holocaust ever occurred are not dissenting historians. People who think that God created the universe in 4004 BC are not dissenting cosmologists. And we will see that people who practice barbarisms like honor killing are not dissenting ethicists. The fact that good ideas are intuitively cached does not make bad ideas any more respectable. Ethics, moral identity, and self-interest. While our ethical concerns are necessarily bound up with the understanding that others experience happiness and suffering, there is more to ethics than the mere knowledge that we are not alone in the world. For ethics to matter to us, the happiness and suffering of others must matter to us. It does matter to us, but why? Strict reductionism does not seem to offer us much hope of insight into ethics. The same, of course, can be said of most higher-level phenomena. Economic behavior necessarily supervenes upon the behavior of atoms, but we will not approach an understanding of economics through particle physics. Fields like game theory and evolutionary biology, for instance, have some plausible stories to tell about the roots of what is generally called altruistic behavior in the scientific literature, but we should not make too much of these stories. The finding that nature seems to have selected for our ethical intuitions is relevant only insofar as it gives the lie to the ubiquitous fallacy that these intuitions are somehow the product of religion. But nature has selected for many things that we would have done well to leave behind us in the jungles of Africa. The practice of rape may have once conferred an adaptive advantage on our species, and rapists of all shapes and sizes can indeed be found in the natural world, dolphins, orangutans, chimpanzees, etc. Does this mean that rape is any less objectionable in human society? Even if we concede that some number of rapes are inevitable, given how human beings are wired, how is this different from saying that some numbers of cancers are inevitable? We will strive to cure cancer in any case. To say that something is natural, or that it has conferred an adaptive advantage upon our species, is not to say that it is good in the required sense of contributing to human happiness in the present. Admittedly, the problem of adjudicating what counts as happiness and which forms of happiness should supersede others is difficult, but so is every other problem worth thinking about. We need only admit that the happiness and suffering of sentient beings, including ourselves, concerns us, and the domain of such concerns is the domain of ethics. To see the possibility that much that is natural in human nature will be at odds with what is good. Appeals to genetics and natural selection can take us only so far, because nature has not adapted us to do anything more than breed. From the point of view of evolution, the best thing a person can do with his life is have as many children as possible. As Steven Pinker observes, if we really took a gene's-eye view of the world, men would line up outside sperm banks, and women would pray to have their eggs harvested and given away to infertile couples. After all, from my genome's point of view, nothing could be more gratifying than the knowledge that I have fathered thousands of children, for whom I now bear no financial responsibility. This, needless to say, is not how most of us seek happiness in this world. Nor are most of us resolutely selfish, in the narrowest sense of the term. Our selfishness extends to those with whom we are morally identified, to friends and family, to co-workers and teammates, and, if we are in an expansive mood, to humans and animals in general. As Jonathan Glover writes, "Our entanglements with people close to us erode simple self-interest. Husbands, wives, lovers, parents, children, and friends all blur the boundaries of selfish concern." Francis Bacon rightly said that people with children have given hostages to fortune. Inescapably, other forms of friendship and love hold us hostage too. Narrow self-interest is destabilized. To treat others ethically is to act out of concern for their happiness and suffering. It is, as Kant observed, to treat them as ends in themselves, rather than as means to some further end. Many ethical injunctions converge here: Kant's categorical imperative, Jesus's golden rule. But the basic facts are these. We experience happiness and suffering ourselves. We encounter others in the world and recognize that they experience happiness and suffering as well. We soon discover that love is largely a matter of wishing that others experience happiness rather than suffering. And most of us come to feel that love is more conducive to happiness, both our own and that of others, than hate. There is a circle here that links us to one another. We each want to be happy. The social feeling of love is one of our greatest sources of happiness, and love entails that we be concerned for the happiness of others. We discover that we can be selfish together. This is just a sketch, but it suggests a clear link between ethics and positive human emotions. The fact that we want the people we love to be happy, and are made happy by love in turn, is an empirical observation. But such observations are the stuff of nascent science. What about people who do not love others, who see no value in it, and yet claim to be perfectly happy? Do such people even exist? Perhaps they do. Does this play havoc with a realistic account of ethics? No more so than an inability to understand the special theory of relativity would cast doubt upon modern physics. Some people can't make heads or tails of the assertion that the passage of time might be relative to one's frame of reference. This prevents them from taking part in any serious discussion of physics. People who see no link between love and happiness may find themselves in the same position with respect to ethics. Differences of opinion do not pose a problem for ethical realism. Consider the practice of honor-killing that persists throughout much of Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. We live in a world in which women and girls are regularly murdered by their male relatives for perceived sexual indiscretions, ranging from merely speaking to a man without permission to falling victim of rape. Coverage of these atrocities in the Western media generally refers to them as a tribal practice, although they almost invariably occur in a Muslim context. Whether we call the beliefs that inspire this behavior tribal or religious is immaterial. The problem is clearly a product of what men in these societies believe about shame and honor, about the role of women, and about female sexuality. One consequence of these beliefs has been to promote rape as a weapon of war. No doubt there are more creaturely and less calculating motives for soldiers to commit rape on a massive scale, but it cannot be denied that male beliefs about honor have made it a brilliant instrument of psychological and cultural oppression. Rape has become a means through which the taboos of a community can be used to rend it from within. Consider the Bosnian women systematically raped by Serbs. One might have thought that since many of their male relatives could not escape getting killed, it would be only reasonable to concede that the women themselves could not escape getting raped. But such flights of ethical intelligence cannot be made with a sufficient payload of unjustified belief. In this case, belief in the intrinsic sinfulness of women, in the importance of virginity prior to marriage, and in the shamefulness of being raped. Needless to say, similar failures of compassion have a venerable pedigree in the Christian West. Augustine, for instance, when considering the moral stature of virgins who had been raped by the Goths, wondered whether they had not been unduly puffed up by their integrity, continence, and chastity. Perhaps they suffered some lurking infirmity which might have betrayed them into proud and contemptuous bearing had they not been subjected to the humiliation that befell them. Perhaps, in other words, they deserved it. Given the requisite beliefs about honor, a man will be desperate to kill his daughter upon learning that she was raped. The same angel of compassion can be expected to visit her brothers as well. Such killings are not at all uncommon in places like Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, Pakistan, Iraq, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. In these parts of the world, a girl of any age who gets raped has brought shame upon her family. Luckily, this shame is not indelible and can be readily expunged with her blood. The subsequent ritual is inevitably a low-tech affair, as none of these societies have devised a system for administering lethal injections for the crime of bringing shame upon one's family. The girl either has her throat cut, or she is doused with gasoline and set on fire, or she is shot. The jail sentences for these men, if they are prosecuted at all, are invariably short. Many are considered heroes in their communities. What can we say about this behavior? Can we say that Middle Eastern men who are murderously obsessed with female sexual purity actually love their wives, daughters, and sisters less than American or European men do? Of course we can. And what is truly incredible about the state of our discourse is that such a claim is not only controversial, but actually unutterable in most contexts. Where's the proof that these men are less capable of love than the rest of us? Well, where would the proof be if a person behaved this way in our own society? Where's the proof that the person who shot JFK didn't really love him? All the proof we need came from the book depository. We know how the word love functions in our discourse. We have all felt love, have failed to feel it, and have occasionally felt its antithesis. Even if we don't harbor the slightest sympathy for their notion of honor, we know what these honor killers are up to, and it is not a matter of expressing their love for the women in their lives. Of course, honor killing is merely one facet in that terrible kaleidoscope that is the untutored male imagination. Dowry deaths and bride burnings, female infanticide, acid attacks, female genital mutilation, sexual slavery. These and other joys await unlucky women throughout much of the world. There is no doubt that certain beliefs are incompatible with love, and this notion of honor is among them. What is love? Few of us will be tempted to consult a dictionary on the subject. We know that we want those we love to be happy. We feel compassion for their suffering. When love is really effective, that is, really felt rather than merely imagined, We cannot help sharing in the joy of those we love, and in their anguish as well. The disposition of love entails the loss, at least to some degree, of our utter self-absorption, and this is surely one of the clues as to why this state of mind is so pleasurable. Most of us will find that cutting a little girl's head off after she has been raped just doesn't capture these sentiments very well. At this point, many anthropologists will want to argue for the importance of cultural context. These murderers are not murderers in the usual sense. They are ordinary, even loving gentlemen, who have become the pawns of tribal custom. Taken to its logical conclusion, this view suggests that any behavior is compatible with any mental state. Perhaps there is a culture in which you are expected to flay your firstborn child alive as an expression of love. But unless everyone in such a culture wants to be flayed alive, this behavior is simply incompatible with love as we know it. The golden rule really does capture many of our intuitions here. We treat those we love more or less the way we would like to be treated ourselves. Honor killers do not seem to be in the habit of asking others to drench them in gasoline and immolate them in turn. Any culture that raises men and boys to kill unlucky girls rather than comfort them is a culture that has managed to retard the growth of love. Such societies, of course, regularly fail to teach their inhabitants many other things, like how to read. Not learning how to read is not another style of literacy, and not learning to see others as ends in themselves is not another style of ethics. It is a failure of ethics. How can we encourage other human beings to extend their moral sympathies beyond a narrow locus? How can we learn to be mere human beings, shorn of any more compelling national, ethnic, or religious identity? We can be reasonable. It is the very nature of reason to fuse cognitive and moral horizons. Reason is nothing less than the guardian of love. Morality and happiness. The link between morality and happiness appears straightforward, though there is clearly more to being happy than merely being moral. There is no reason to think that a person who never lies, cheats, or steals is guaranteed to be happier than a person who commits each of these sins with abandon. As we all know, a kind and compassionate person can still be horribly unlucky, and many a brute appears to have seized fortune herself by the skirts. Children born without a functioning copy of the gene that produces the enzyme hypoxanthine guanine phosphorobosyltransferase will have a constellation of ailments and incapacities known as Lesh-Nyhan syndrome. They will also compulsively mutilate themselves, possibly as a result of the buildup of uric acid in their tissues. If left unrestrained, such children helplessly gnaw their lips and fingers, and even thrust pointed objects into their eyes. It is difficult to see how instruction in morality will contribute meaningfully to their happiness. What these children need is not better moral instruction, or even more parental love. They need hypoxanthine guanine phosphorobosyltransferase. Without denying that happiness has many requisites, good genes, a nervous system that does not entirely misbehave, etc., we can hypothesize that whatever a person's current level of happiness is, his condition will be generally improved by his becoming yet more loving and compassionate, and hence more ethical. This is a strictly empirical claim, one that has been tested for millennia by contemplatives in a variety of spiritual traditions, especially within Buddhism. We might wonder whether, in the limit, the unchecked growth of love and compassion might lead to the diminution of a person's sense of well-being, as the suffering of others becomes increasingly his own. Only people who have cultivated these states of mind to an extraordinary degree will be in a position to decide this question. But in the general case, there seems to be no doubt that love and compassion are good, in that they connect us more deeply to others. Given this situation, We can see that one could desire to become more loving and compassionate for purely selfish reasons. This is a paradox of sorts, because these attitudes undermine selfishness by definition. They also inspire behavior that tends to contribute to the happiness of other human beings. These states of mind not only feel good, they ramify social relationships that lead one to feel good with others, leading others to feel good with oneself. Hate, envy, spite, disgust, shame. These are not sources of happiness, personally or socially. Love and compassion are. Like so much that we know about ourselves, claims of this sort need not be validated by a controlled study. We can easily imagine evolutionary reasons for why positive social emotions make us feel good, while negative ones do not. But they would be beside the point. The point is that the disposition to take the happiness of others into account, to be ethical, seems to be a rational way to augment one's own happiness. As we will see in the next chapter, the linkage here becomes increasingly relevant the more rarefied one's happiness becomes. The connection between spirituality, the cultivation of happiness directly through precise refinements of attention, and ethics is well attested. Certain attitudes and behaviors seem to be conducive to contemplative insight, while others are not. This is not a proposition to be merely believed. It is rather a hypothesis to be tested in the laboratory of one's life. A loophole for Torquemada? Casting questions about ethics in terms of happiness and suffering can quickly lead us into unfamiliar territory. Consider the case of judicial torture. It would seem at first glance to be unambiguously evil. And yet, for the first time in living memory, reasonable men and women in our country have begun to reconsider it publicly. Interest in the subject appears to have been provoked by an interview given by Alan Dershowitz, an erstwhile champion of the rights of the innocent until proven guilty, on CBS's 60 Minutes. There, before millions who would have thought the concept of torture impossible to rehabilitate, Dershowitz laid out the paradigmatic ticking bomb case. Imagine that a known terrorist has planted a large bomb in the heart of a nearby city. This man now sits in your custody. As to the bomb's location, he will say nothing except that the site was chosen to produce the maximum loss of life. Given the state of affairs, in particular, given that there is still time to prevent an imminent atrocity, it seems there would be no harm in dusting off the strappado and exposing this unpleasant fellow to assuasion of bygone times. Dershowitz has argued that this situation can be cast in terms that will awaken the Grand Inquisitor in all of us. If a ticking bomb doesn't move you, picture your 7-year-old daughter being slowly asphyxiated in a warehouse just 5 minutes away, while the man in your custody holds the keys to her release. If your daughter won't tip the scales, then add the daughters of every couple for 1,000 miles. Millions of little girls have, by some perverse negligence on the part of our government, come under the control of an evil genius who now sits before you in shackles. Clearly, the consequences of one man's uncooperativeness can be made so grave, and his malevolence and culpability so transparent, as to stir even the most self-hating moral relativist from his dogmatic slumbers. It is generally thought that the gravest ethical problem we face in resorting to torture is that we would be bound to torture some number of innocent men and women. Most of us who were eager to don the Inquisitor's cap in the case above begin to falter in more realistic scenarios as a person's guilt becomes a matter of some uncertainty. And this is long before other concerns even attract our notice. What, for instance, is the reliability of testimony elicited under torture? We need not even pose questions of this sort yet, since we have already balked at the knowledge that, in the real world, we will not be able to tell the guilty from the innocent just by looking. So it seems that we have two situations that will strike most sane and decent people as ethically distinct. In the first case, as envisioned by Dershowitz, it seems perverse to worry about the rights of an admitted terrorist when so many innocent lives are at stake. While under more realistic conditions, uncertainty about a person's guilt will generally preclude the use of torture. Is this how the matter really sits with us? Probably not. It appears that such restraint in the use of torture cannot be reconciled with our willingness to wage war in the first place. What, after all, is collateral damage but the inadvertent torture of innocent men, women, and children? Whenever we consent to drop bombs, we do so with the knowledge that some number of children will be blinded, disemboweled, paralyzed, orphaned, and killed by them. It is curious that while the torture of Osama bin Laden himself could be expected to provoke convulsions of conscience among our leaders, the unintended, though perfectly foreseeable and therefore accepted, slaughter of children does not. So we can now ask, if we are willing to act in a way that guarantees the misery and death of some considerable number of innocent children, why spare the rod with suspected terrorists? What is the difference between pursuing a course of action where we run the risk of inadvertently subjecting some innocent men to torture, and pursuing one in which we will inadvertently kill far greater numbers of innocent men, women, and children? Rather, it seems obvious that the misapplication of torture should be far less troubling to us than collateral damage. There are, after all, no infants interned at Guantanamo Bay, just rather scrofulous young men, many of whom were caught in the very act of trying to kill our soldiers. Torture need not even impose a significant risk of death or permanent injury on its victims, while the collaterally damaged are, almost by definition, crippled or killed. The ethical divide that seems to be opening up here suggests that those who are willing to drop bombs might want to abduct the nearest and dearest of suspected terrorists, their wives, mothers, and daughters, and torture them as well, assuming anything profitable to our side might come of it. Admittedly, this would be a ghastly result to have reached by logical argument, and we will want to find some way of escaping it. In this context, we should note that many variables influence our feelings about an act of physical violence, as well as our intuitions about its ethical status. As Glover points out, in modern war, what is most shocking is a poor guide to what is most harmful. To learn that one's grandfather flew a bombing mission over Dresden in the Second World War is one thing. To hear that he killed five little girls and their mother with a shovel is another. We can be sure that he would have killed more women and girls by dropping bombs from pristine heights, and they are likely to have died equally horrible deaths, but his culpability would not appear the same. Indeed, we seem to know intuitively that it would take a different kind of person to perpetrate violence of the latter sort, and, as we might expect, the psychological effects of participating in these types of violence are generally distinct. Consider the following account of a Soviet soldier in Afghanistan. "It's frightening and unpleasant to have to kill," you think, but you soon realize that what you really find objectionable is shooting someone point blank. Killing en masse, in a group, is exciting. Even, and I've seen this myself, fun. This is not to say that no one has ever enjoyed killing people up close. It is just that we all recognize that such enjoyment requires an unusual degree of callousness to the suffering of others. It is possible that we are simply unequipped to rectify this disparity, to be, in Glover's terms, most shocked by what is most harmful. A biological rationale is not hard to find, as millions of years on the African veldt could not possibly have selected for an ability to make emotional sense of 21st century horror. That our Paleolithic genes now have chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons at their disposal is, from the point of view of our evolution, little different from our having delivered this technology into the hands of chimps. The difference between killing one man and killing 1,000 just doesn't seem as salient to us as it should. And, as Glover observes, in many cases, we will find the former far more disturbing. 3 million souls can be starved and murdered in the Congo, and our argus-eyed media scarcely blink. When a princess dies in a car accident, however, a quarter of the Earth's population falls prostrate with grief. Perhaps we are unable to feel what we must feel in order to change our world. What does it feel like to see 3,000 men, women, and children incinerated and crushed to ash in the span of a few seconds? Anyone who owned a television on September 11, 2001, now knows. But most of us know nothing of the sort. To have watched the World Trade Center absorbing 2 jet planes, along with the lives of thousands, and to have felt, above all things, disbelief, suggests some form of neurological impairment. Clearly, there are limits to what the human mind can make of the deliverances of its senses, of the mere sight of an office building known to be full of people dissolving into rubble. Perhaps this will change. In any case, if you think the equivalence between torture and collateral damage does not hold, because torture is up close and personal, while stray bombs aren't, you stand convicted of a failure of imagination on at least 2 counts. First, a moment's reflection on the horrors that must have been visited upon innocent Afghanis and Iraqis by our bombs will reveal that they are on par with those of any dungeon. That such an exercise of the imagination is required to bring torture and collateral damage to parity accounts for the dissociation between what is most shocking and what is most harmful, that Glover notes. It also demonstrates the degree to which we have been bewitched by our own euphemisms. Killing people at a distance is easier, but perhaps it should not be that much easier. Second, if our intuition about the wrongness of torture is born of an aversion to how people generally behave while being tortured, we should note that this particular infelicity could be circumvented pharmacologically, because paralytic drugs make it unnecessary for screaming ever to be heard, or writhing seen. We could easily devise methods of torture that would render a torturer as blind to the plight of his victims as a bomber pilot is at 30,000 feet. Consequently, our natural aversion to the sights and sounds of the dungeon provides no foothold for those who would argue against the use of torture. To demonstrate just how abstract the torments of the tortured can be made to seem, we need only imagine an ideal torture pill, a drug that would deliver both the instruments of torture and the instrument of their utter concealment. The action of the pill would be to produce transitory paralysis and transitory misery of a kind that no human being would willingly submit to a second time. Imagine how we torturers would feel if, after giving this pill to captive terrorists, each lay down for what appeared to be an hour's nap, only to arise and immediately confess everything he knows about the workings of his organization. Might we not be tempted to call it a truth pill in the end? No, there is no ethical difference to be found in how the suffering of the tortured or the collaterally damaged appears. Which way should the balance swing? Assuming that we want to maintain a coherent ethical position on these matters, this appears to be a circumstance of forced choice. If we are willing to drop bombs, or even risk that pistol rounds might go astray, we should be willing to torture a certain class of criminal suspects and military prisoners. If we are unwilling to torture, we should be unwilling to wage modern war. Opponents of torture will be quick to argue that confessions elicited by torture are notoriously unreliable. Given the foregoing, however, this objection seems to lack its usual force. Make these confessions as unreliable as you like. The chance that our interests will be advanced in any instance of torture need only equal the chance of such occasioned by the dropping of a single bomb. What was the chance that the dropping of bomb number 117 on Kandahar would affect the demise of Al-Qaeda? It had to be pretty slim. Enter Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, our most valuable capture in the War on Terror. Here is a character who actually seems cut from Dershowitzian cloth. U.S. officials now believe that his was the hand that decapitated the Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. Whether or not this is true, his membership in Al-Qaeda more or less rules out his innocence in any important sense, and his rank in the organization suggests that his knowledge of planned atrocities must be extensive. The bomb is ticking. Given the damage we were willing to cause to the bodies and minds of innocent children in Afghanistan and Iraq, our disavowal of torture in the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed seems perverse. If there is even one chance in a million that he will tell us something under torture that will lead to the further dismantling of Al-Qaeda, it seems that we should use every means at our disposal to get him talking. In all likelihood, you began reading this chapter much as I began writing it, convinced that torture is a very bad thing, and that we are not wise to practice it, indeed, that we are civilized, in large measure, because we do not practice it. Most of us feel, intuitively at least, that if we can't quite muster a retort to Dershowitz and his ticking bomb, we can take refuge in the fact that the paradigmatic case will almost never arise. From this perspective, adorning the machinery of our justice system with a torture provision seems both unnecessary and dangerous, as the law of unintended consequences may one day find it throwing the whole works into disarray. Because I believe the account offered above is basically sound, I believe that I have successfully argued for the use of torture in any circumstance in which we would be willing to cause collateral damage. Paradoxically, this equivalence has not made the practice of torture seem any more acceptable to me, nor has it, I trust, for most readers. I believe that here we come upon an ethical illusion of sorts, analogous to the perceptual illusions that are of such abiding interest to scientists who study the visual pathways in the brain. The full moon appearing on the horizon is no bigger than the full moon when it appears overhead, but it looks bigger, for reasons that are still obscure to neuroscientists. A ruler held up to the sky reveals something that we are otherwise incapable of seeing, even when we understand that our eyes are deceiving us. Given a choice between acting on the basis of the way things seem in this instance, or on the deliverances of our ruler, most of us will be willing to dispense with appearances, particularly if our lives, or the lives of others, depended on it. I believe that most readers who have followed me this far will find themselves in substantially the same position with respect to the ethics of torture. Given what many of us believe about the exigencies of our war on terrorism, the practice of torture in certain circumstances would seem to be not only permissible, but necessary. Still, it does not seem any more acceptable in ethical terms than it did before. The reasons for this are, I trust, every bit as neurological as those that give rise to the moon illusion. In fact, there is already some scientific evidence that our ethical intuitions are driven by considerations of proximity and emotional salience of the sort I addressed above. Clearly, these intuitions are fallible. In the present case, many innocent lives could well be lost as a result of our inability to feel a moral equivalence, where a moral equivalence seems to exist. It may be time to take out our rulers and hold them up to the sky. The false choice of pacifism. Pacifism is generally considered to be a morally unassailable position to take with respect to human violence. The worst that is said of it generally is that it is a difficult position to maintain in practice. It is almost never branded as flagrantly immoral, which I believe it is. While it can seem noble enough when the stakes are low, pacifism is ultimately nothing more than a willingness to die and to let others die at the pleasure of the world's thugs. It should be enough to note that a single sociopath, armed with nothing more than a knife, could exterminate a city full of pacifists. There is no doubt that such sociopaths exist, and they are generally better armed. Fearing that the above reflections on torture may offer a potent argument for pacifism, I would like to briefly state why I believe we must accept the fact that violence, or its threat, is often an ethical necessity. I was once walking the streets of Prague, late at night, and came upon a man and a young woman in the midst of a struggle. As I drew nearer, it became obvious that the man, who appeared to be both drunk and enraged, was attempting to pull the woman into a car against her will. She was making a forceful show of resistance, but he had seized her arm with one hand and was threatening to strike her in the face with the other, which he had done at least once, it seemed, before I arrived on the scene. The rear door of the car was open, and an accomplice had taken a seat behind the wheel. Several other men were milling about, and from the looks of them, they appeared to approve of the abduction in progress. Without knowing how I would proceed, I at once found myself interceding on the woman's behalf. As my adrenaline rose and her assailant's attention turned my way, it occurred to me that his English might be terrible or non-existent. The mere effort to understand me could be made so costly that it might prove a near total diversion. The inability to make my intentions clear would also serve to forestall actual conflict. Had we shared a common language, our encounter would have almost certainly come to blows within moments, as I would have thought of nothing more clever than to demand that he let the woman go, and he, to save face, would have demanded that I make him. Since he had at least two friends that I could see, and several fans, my evening would probably have ended very badly. Thus, my goal, as I saw it, was to remain unintelligible, without antagonizing any of the assembled hooligans, long enough for the young woman to get away. "Excuse me," I said. "I seem to have lost my hotel, my lodging, my place of residence, where I lie supine, not prone. Can you help me? Where is it? Where is it?" "Sex?" the man asked with obvious outrage, as though I had declared myself a rival for his prisoner's affections. It now occurred to me that the woman might be a prostitute, and he an unruly customer. "No, not sex. I am looking for a specific building. It has no aluminum siding or stained glass. It could be filled with marzipan. Do you know where it is? This is an emergency." In an instant, the man's face underwent a remarkable transformation, changing from a mask of rage to a vision of perplexity itself. While he attempted to decipher my request, I threw a conspiratorial glance at the woman, who, it must be said, seemed rather slow to appreciate that the moment of her emancipation was at hand. The man began to discuss my case in fluent Czech with one of his friends. I continued to rave. The woman, for her part, glared at me as though I were an idiot. Then, realizing her opportunity for the first time, like a bird that had long sat within an open cage, she suddenly broke free and fled down the street. Her erstwhile attacker was too engrossed by his reflections even to notice that she had left. Mission accomplished, I at once thanked the group and moved on. While my conduct in the above incident seems to meet with the approval of almost everyone, I relate it here because I consider it an example of a moral failure. First, I was lying, and lying out of fear. I was not lost, and I needed no assistance of any kind. I resorted to this tactic because, quite frankly, I was afraid to openly challenge an indeterminate number of drunks to a brawl. Some may call this wisdom, but it seemed to me to be nothing more than cowardice at the time. I made no effort to communicate with these men, to appeal to their ethical scruples, however inchoate, or to make any impression upon them whatsoever. I perceived them not as ends in themselves, as sentient creatures capable of dialogue, appeasement, or instruction, but as a threat in its purest form. My ethical failure, as I see it, is that I never actually opposed their actions. Hence, they never received any correction from the world. They were merely diverted for a time, and to only a single woman's advantage. The next woman who became the object of their predations will have little cause to thank me. Even if a frank intercession on the woman's behalf would have guaranteed my own injury, a clear message would have been sent. Not all strangers will stand idly by as you beat and abduct a woman in the street. the action I took sent no such message. Indeed, I suspect that even the woman herself never knew that I had come to her aid. Gandhi was undoubtedly the 20th century's most influential pacifist. The success he enjoyed in forcing the British Empire to withdraw from the Indian subcontinent brought pacifism down from the ethers of religious precept and gave it new political relevance. Pacifism in this form no doubt required considerable bravery from its practitioners and constituted a direct confrontation with injustice. As such, it had far more moral integrity than did my stratagem above. It is clear, however, that Gandhi's nonviolence can be applied to only a limited range of human conflict. We would do well to reflect on Gandhi's remedy for the Holocaust. He believed that the Jews should have committed mass suicide, because this would have aroused the world and the people of Germany to Hitler's violence. We might wonder what a world full of pacifists would have done once it had grown aroused. Commit suicide as well? Gandhi was a religious dogmatist, of course, but his remedy for the Holocaust seems ethically suspect, even if one accepts the metaphysical premises upon which it was based. If we grant the law of karma and rebirth to which Gandhi subscribed, his pacifism still seems highly immoral. Why should it be thought ethical to safeguard one's own happiness, or even the happiness of others, in the next life, at the expense of the manifest agony of children in this one? Gandhi's was a world in which millions more would have died, in the hopes that the Nazis would one day doubt the goodness of their thousand-year Reich. Ours is a world in which bombs must occasionally fall, where such doubts are in short supply. Here we come upon a terrible facet of ethically asymmetric warfare. When your enemy has no scruples, your own scruples become another weapon in his hand. It is as yet unclear what it will mean to win our war on terrorism, or whether the religious barbarism that animates our enemies can ever be finally purged from our world. But it is all too obvious what it would mean to lose it. Life under the Taliban is, to a first approximation, what millions of Muslims around the world want to impose on the rest of us. They long to establish a society in which, when times are good, women will remain vanquished and invisible, and anyone given to spiritual, intellectual, or sexual freedom will be slaughtered before crowds of sullen, uneducated men. This, needless to say, is a vision of life worth resisting. We cannot let our qualms over collateral damage paralyze us, because our enemies know no such qualms. Theirs is a kill-the-children-first approach to war, and we ignore the fundamental difference between their violence and our own, at our peril. Given the proliferation of weaponry in our world, we no longer have the option of waging this war with swords. It seems certain that collateral damage of various sorts will be a part of our future for many years to come.